Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont, who testified Tuesday before a Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on Taking Back Our Democracy, Responding to Citizens United and the Rise of Super PACs. We will discuss his testimony, in which he said that we are well on our way to seeing our great country move towards an oligarchic form of government. Then we'll examine the unprecedented melting of the Greenland ice sheet with climate scientist Thomas Moat, who has been using satellite imagery to study ice changes in Greenland for the past 20 years. We will discuss this phenomenon in the overall context of climate change, where receding glaciers and a Grand Canyon-sized rift from speeding ice melt in Antarctic, plus record droughts and floods, indicate that something is amiss. Then finally, we will speak with Timothy Snyder, professor of history at Yale, who spoke yesterday at the Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C., along with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and other foreign policy experts about ways to avert future genocides. We will discuss how climate change and resource crises will cause ecological panic that will lead to mass killings in the decades to come. Joining us now is Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. Senator Sanders was elected to the United States Senate in 2006 after serving 16 years in the House of Representatives. He is the longest-serving independent member of Congress in American history. On Tuesday, he testified before the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on the Constitution, Civil Rights, and Human Rights on Taking Back Our Democracy, Responding to Citizens United and the Rise of the Super PACs. Welcome to Background Briefing, Senator Sanders.
Good to be with you.
And I must say that I think that for all of our history of the great American Revolution and being a democratic model to the rest of the world, as you watch this year unfold, one of the things I find just absolutely extraordinary is that American citizens who are registered voters and who particularly want to vote Democratic have to jump through hoops to prove who they are, whereas billionaires who are essentially buying the elections for the Republicans don't have to identify who they are.
Well, I think that's a very important and perceptive thought. What we are seeing in America today economically is a movement toward oligarchy in the sense of fewer and fewer people owning more and more of our country, the United States having the worst distribution of wealth and income of any major country on earth, and worse than at any time since the Great Depression. Politically, what we're seeing is two things. Number one, with this disastrous Citizens United decision, the door is now wide open for billionaires to contribute as much money as they want into the political process, often in secret. And second of all, what our Republican friends are doing in many of their states is they are making it harder and harder for lower-income people or older people to vote by requiring onus of voter identification requirements. And you add that together on one hand, as you've just indicated, the doors are wide open for billionaires to contribute. On the other hand, the doors are closing for people to participate in the political process. Add that all together, and I think you have a very sad day for American democratic traditions.
But it's worse in the sense that billionaires don't have to disclose who they are. And what
right.
troubles a lot of people is that these 501c4s that don't require the identification of the donor could mean that corporate America could be pouring money in. And we know that from what happened in Minnesota, where Target put up some money for a very homophobic candidate, and there was a tremendous backlash, and Target were quickly apologetic. We know that corporations are nervous about identifying their
absolutely.
Political donations because either half their customers are Republican or half of them
right.
are Democrats.
No, absolutely. No question. Look, short term, what we need is something like a Disclose Act. And what a Disclose Act, which was on the floor of the Senate very recently, which did not receive any Republican votes, what the Disclose Act simply stated was that if you're going to contribute money into a political campaign of more than $10,000, you have to be identified. And I don't think that that is an unfair requirement. People have a right to know where money is coming from in the political process. The second part of the Disclose Act, which was dropped in an effort which didn't work to get Republican votes, would have said that if you're running a third-party ad, if you're a corporation running an ad, you have to have the CEO of the company on the TV screen as candidates do and say, I authorize this, I approve this ad. That's what I would have to do as a candidate if I ran a TV ad. And we said, hey, let the CEOs of large corporations be on the television doing that as well, for exactly the reason that you gave. And that is, if a big corporation wants to get involved in the political process, let the American people know that. And let them know, let them think twice about whether or not they want to purchase that product. And I think that many CEOs would have said, you know what, we're not going to get involved in the political process. Short term, we need to pass a Disclose Act which has those components. Longer term, in my view, we need to overturn Citizens United, which is why I and several other members of the Senate and others in the House have introduced constitutional amendments to do just that.
And that was a hearing chaired yesterday by Dick Durbin, along with Senator Udall and Max Baucus and Congresswoman Donna Edwards. You, Senator Bernie Sanders, you mentioned earlier, you said the country is moving towards an oligarchic government, but you gave some pretty damning evidence of the maldistribution of wealth. Today, the 400 wealthiest individuals own more wealth than the bottom half of America's 150 million people. One family, the Walton family of Walmart fame, with 89 billion, own more wealth than the bottom 40% of Americans, and today the top 1% own 40% of all wealth, and the bottom 40% of all Americans own just 0.3% of the wealth of the country. It's absolutely...
That's really extraordinary, isn't it?
It's amazing.
And we don't talk about it. I mean, for fairly obvious reasons, we don't talk about the fact that economically the billionaires are, you know, just own a lion's share of this nation. The fact that one family, the Walton family from Walmart, owns more wealth than the bottom 40% of families in America is really quite extraordinary. And what the reason why Citizens United is so important in terms of this discussion is that what these billionaires are doing is not just sitting on their money, they're not putting it under the mattress. We also pointed out in my testimony that, you know, it's not just the Koch brothers or Sheldon Adelson who are making major contributions. 25 billionaires have contributed at least, up to this point, $250,000 into the political process in this campaign. And that's a conservative number because, as we talked about earlier, there's a lot of secret contributions going on. But we know at least 25 billionaires who have contributed $250,000. So what's happening is the very wealthiest people in this country who already own a lion's share of the wealth, who are already earning a lion's share of the income in this country, are saying, that's not enough. We want even more. And we're going to buy the United States government in the process. And if you think about it from an economic point of view, it's not a bad investment. You know, you can own a coal company, you can own an oil company, you can own parts of Wall Street. But owning the United States government for a few $100 million or having significant control over the United States government, that is a pretty good investment. And that's the way these guys see it, and that's exactly what they're doing.
So in other words, you own it, you own the government for essentially chump change.
Right. Yeah. I mean, if you were worth $50 billion, if you had major investments in coal, oil, or financial institutions, whatever it may be, putting a few $100 million into the political process so you have a significant control, say, of the Republican Party, man, that is a very good investment. I mean, one little tax break will earn you that back in spades.
So, Senator Bernie Sanders, I believe that on your, is it your website where you can get a list of these 25 billionaire families?
Yes. Yep, it's on
sanders.senate.gov.
Yeah.
Sanders.senate.gov, and it's fairly easy to find.
We've installed 25 of them, and, you know, at the top of the list is, you know, the Koch brothers, of course, and Sheldon Adelson, but there are 23 others as well that we know of.
So, Senator Sanders, when Senator Durbin acknowledged at the hearing that you testified at yesterday before the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on the Constitution, Civil Rights, and Human Rights, he said that amending the Constitution would be an uphill battle and it may take years. That, of course, is the bar that the Founding Fathers set. My understanding is that, what is it, two-thirds of the legislatures in the country have to pass the vote by two-thirds? Is that the bar?
Right, and then you got three-quarters of the states.
Three-quarters of the states. So two-thirds of the legislature, three-quarters of the states.
That's a pretty high bar, and it's not going to become, it's not easy. But, you know, we have, obviously, as everybody knows, passed major constitutional amendments, and I think what we're beginning to see in is we have six states already, including the state of Vermont, that have gone forward in saying that they would like to see that. They would like a constitutional amendment to come to them. We've got, I believe, hundreds of cities and towns, many in Vermont, I think Los Angeles, New York City, and others have also made that statement. So I think you're seeing, and yesterday, actually, at the hearing, we had petitions coming from, I believe, 1.9 million Americans who want to see Citizens United overturned. So I think what you're seeing out there is a very strong grassroots movement at the local level, at the state level, and at the national level, who are people who are understanding that this disastrous 5-4 Supreme Court decision of 2 years ago is a major step backwards in the struggle for America, for democracy in our country.
And Senator Udall, that spoke with you, said America's right to free speech is now determined by their net worth. Elections become more about the quality of cash and less about the quality of ideas. And there was a panel that followed you with the Governor Buddy Romer, who I invited out to speak at the forum I do at UCLA. He's a very, very powerful speaker, and he's lived it, hasn't he? He tried to run for for president of the United States and couldn't even get into the debates because he set a bar at a limit of $100. It just shows you how the game is rigged. But very few, I believe very few Republican senators showed up, if none at all, right?
When I was there, I did not see any, and I don't believe any showed up.
Right. And then there was a representative that Senator Lindsey Graham brought in from the Cato Institute, right?
Yes, I think somebody did testify.
And well, I believe that Senator Whitehouse, talking with the defender of Citizens United from the Cato Institute, talked about a Marine who lost his legs in Afghanistan, who he was talking to on the way to the hearing. And if the U.S. can ask a Marine to go to Afghanistan and lose his legs, said Senator Whitehouse, we can ask the Koch brothers to disclose their contributions and deal with some impolite blogging. Again, it gets back to this extraordinary disconnect, this breathtaking hypocrisy that the billionaires don't have to disclose who they are and how much money they're giving, but average citizens, including those that fight and die for the United States or lose their legs, they're getting essentially hassled.
Yeah. Well, look, the bottom line here, I think it's not very complicated to understand, is that the hypocrisy comes from the fact that for many years, many Republicans, not all, opposed any form of campaign finance reform. And their mantra was, we don't need campaign finance reform if we have disclosure. You know, let the people know who's contributing money, and we don't need any kinds of regulations. That's been their line until now. And now what they're saying is, we don't want any disclosure at all. And they come up with really kind of crazy reasons as to why that they believe that. But the real political bottom line here is the Republicans understand that Citizens United is working very, very well for them. Mitch McConnell, in the Citizens United case, who's leader of the Senate Republican Party, was offered a friend of the court paper on that. He supported it very strongly. And now what's happening is Republicans are bringing in huge amounts of money from some of the wealthiest people in this country, flooding the airways all over the country, and they like it. They like it. And we can't get one of them to say that at the very least, I mean, obviously we've got to go a lot further than that, but we can't get one Republican to say that when you're going to contribute huge amounts of money, you at least have to tell the American people who you are.
Well, just in closing, Senator Sanders, it's not just Citizens United, though. The underlying money equals voting comes from Buckley v. Valeo. So just give us a sense of the actual constitutional amendment itself. So that imagine.
Most importantly, what it says is, first of all, a corporation is not a person. And second of all, what it says is that in practical terms, of course, the United States Congress and state legislatures do have the right to regulate campaign spending. And those are the most important features in my constitutional amendment.
Well, I thank you very much, and I hope, I trust that we'll hear more of this. Obviously, this
is a huge issue, Ian, yeah. And I certainly hope that we hear a whole lot about it.
Well, this is going to require the citizens of the United States to push this through, and as you mentioned, it's happened before, so even though it's a high bar, it still can be met.
Yes, and it should be met. So we're going to work on this issue, and thanks very much for your interest in it.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. Senator Sanders was elected to the United States Senate in 2006 after serving 16 years in the House of Representatives. He's the longest-serving independent member of Congress in American history, and on Tuesday he testified before the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on the Constitution, Civil Rights, and Human Rights on taking back our democracy, responding to Citizens United, and the rise of the super PACs. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the melting of the Greenland glaciers.
Oh, the grocer, though we have fun, tax collectors getting closer, still we have fun. There's nothing surer, the rich get rich and the poor get poorer. In the meantime, in between time, ain't we got fun?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Thomas Mott, who's a climate scientist and head of the Department of Geography at the University of Georgia. For 20 years, he's been using satellite imagery to study changes in Greenland's ice sheet. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Mott.
Thank you very much.
And you've been studying for 20 years, and NASA has now revealed that Greenland's ice sheet has melted to an extent not witnessed in 30 years of satellite observations. So I take it that what's happening now is unprecedented.
It's certainly unprecedented during what we would call the satellite era, or the period that we have satellite data to look at Greenland. From what we can tell, it's probably unprecedented in our lifetime. There is some evidence that we have seen events like this in the past. People have been able to determine that by looking at ice cores, literally cores taken from the surface of the ice sheet.
So there's climate change and there's climate variability. So what is this about? Is this about climate change or climate variability?
Well, that's an interesting question. We really have an extreme event, this almost complete coverage of the ice sheet with melt during the middle of July is an extreme event. That's embedded within a period of what looks like changing climate in the Arctic and over Greenland. So this one event itself is probably not an indication of either climate change or necessarily climate variability. It's an example of a unique weather pattern that's set up that happened to occur at a time of year when we would see a lot of melt anyway. But the longer-term trends that we're witnessing over the ice sheet are consistent with projections of climate change and with other observations in the Arctic.
So the reason that this is important, it has political weight, because I think the United States is the only country in the world that still has a debate about whether or not climate change is real. And those on the denial side seize upon any evidence that this has happened before, that there's any cyclical nature. And apparently the last time this happened was 150 years ago.
Last time we believe this happened was 1889, and that's based on some ice cores that were dated at the University of Dartmouth. Having said that, again, I would go back to the point that we have this singular event. Yes, the singular event was quite unusual, something unique during the satellite era, during our lifetimes, but that's embedded within a period of increasingly frequent melt around the margins of the ice sheet, increasingly long melt seasons around the margins of the ice sheet. And if we want to talk about issues surrounding climate change, we probably need to focus on some of those observations rather than this really spectacular event, but a singular event.
So the idea that a piece of ice, what, twice the size of Manhattan breaks off, or I think there was an earlier one where a piece of ice four times the size of Manhattan broke off, that is not a sign that the ice sheet is melting.
Well, I think in many cases, from what I've seen, and I'm not involved directly in that work, that the very warm waters that are surrounding Greenland, which again are associated with the kinds of changes we've seen in the Arctic over the last few decades, were associated with that, with the Petermann breakup. But not necessarily directly related to what we were seeing over the interior of the ice sheet in the work that we did.
So the fact that something similar is happening in the Antarctic, where there's a rift in the Antarctic rock as deep as the Grand Canyon, it's been discovered by the British Antarctic Survey. That's being attributed to global warming and being a unique phenomenon. You're suggesting that these large icebergs being formed are not necessarily an indicator of a point of change in terms of global climate. And because my understanding is that once things start to melt in terms of global warming, you get a kind of built-in cycle that the salinity of the ocean changes because more fresh water is entering the salt water, and that's likely to affect the ocean currents, and it thus becomes kind of reinforcing, and you're on a sort of spiral towards far more serious problems. Is that what we possibly could be facing?
Well, first let me say that I'm certainly not suggesting that these changes we're seeing are not associated with global warming. In fact, as I said, the changes that we're seeing around the margins of Greenland are certainly consistent with the kinds of increasing temperatures that we've seen around Greenland and surrounding areas, the increased ocean temperatures near Greenland. And those changes are consistent with the kinds of things that we've been expecting to occur in a changing climate. My point was simply that the very short event that caused melt at the very highest elevations of Greenland by itself is probably not a good indicator. But the changes we're seeing across the ice sheet probably are consistent with the kinds of changes that we would expect. And certainly some of the changes that we would expect to see would be increased ice lost from both Antarctica and certainly from Greenland. And that mass is lost, the ice is lost in a couple of different ways. One way is that it melts. Some of that meltwater runs off the surface or it runs through the ice down to the base of the ice sheet and then out outlet rivers and outlet glaciers into the ocean. And the other way that the ice sheet loses ice is through breaking off or calving of icebergs into the ocean. And we would expect both of those to increase in a warming climate, and so far that's what we've seen.
Again, I'm speaking with Thomas Mode, climate scientist and head of the Department of Geography at the University of Georgia. He's been studying, through satellite imagery, been studying the changes in the Greenland ice sheet for the past 20 years, and NASA has just revealed on Tuesday from satellite observations that the Greenland ice sheet has melted to an extent not witnessed in 30 years. So can we combine, though, this information from the Antarctic, from the Arctic, from Greenland, and from observations, which I think are pretty unassailable, that some of the big glaciers are melting? For example, I just spoke with a friend who went up to Glacier Bay, and apparently when Explorer Vancouver discovered it, you couldn't even see the bay. It was just a wall of ice. And now you go 87 miles into the bay to find the glacier.
Well, there's certainly evidence of glacial retreat all across the Northern Hemisphere. It's a little trickier when you start comparing the Northern Hemisphere to the Southern Hemisphere, but just looking Pan-Arctic, we've certainly seen widespread glacial retreat in many locations, not everywhere, but certainly the majority of locations, in some cases quite dramatic. We've seen recent years declining snow cover. We know that June of this year had the least snow cover for both Eurasia and North America and the Northern Hemisphere combined. Granted, there's not a lot of snow in June, but there is some at high latitudes. We know that sea ice has been declining precipitously in recent years. And then we see these changes around the margins of Greenland. So I think that you can combine these various sources of information with a lot of other information, too, from observational records, from meteorological stations, actually with personal observations as well, too. I have a colleague of mine at the University of Georgia that works with Native peoples in northern Alaska documenting impacts of climate change on their lives. So I think there are many different sources that we can put together to get a complete picture.
So, and of course, I don't know that all of the dots are connected here, but anecdotally, of course, you know, I've just been talking to some agronomists recently about the droughts in the American breadbasket. Apparently, there are droughts in Australia, Ukraine, and Russia that's going to affect the world food supply. It just feels like this information is coming pretty thick and fast in terms of what would seem to be related effects from the fact that the Earth seems to be getting hotter.
Certainly does feel that way, doesn't it? Not only droughts in places like the South Central United States into the Great Plains, we've seen places where we've had unusual flooding, for example. So Duluth, Minnesota, not a place that you normally think about when you think about flooding, but massive rainfalls earlier this summer produced extensive flooding there. The changes that we just talked about in higher latitudes with glaciers, sea ice, what we've seen on Greenland. So, you know, people talk about this concept, recently have talked about this concept of global weirding or just stranger than normal weather. And I think there is something to that. Certainly we do see a number of different elements of climate that change, are all changing at the same time. And as I always talk to the general public, to my students about, it's in many cases the pace of change that we're more concerned about or as concerned about than the absolute magnitude of change. And it's the rapidity in which changes take place that in many ways make it difficult to adapt or to deal with the situation.
But am I correct in the idea that you reach a kind of, I guess the best description I can think of is a breaking point or a point of no return, where it becomes self-reinforcing? The more, for example, that the tundra melts, the more methane that is released, the more that the ice melts, the less amount of sunlight is reflected back into space from the white snow, and therefore it becomes absorbed by the black ocean or the dark ocean. And then the more fresh water that melts into the salt water of the ocean, it affects the salinity, which in turn affects the ocean currents. Isn't this a basic problem here, that there's a kind of self-reinforcing nature that spirals out of control at a certain point?
Well, you've touched on a couple of important elements of climate that we talk about when we're dealing with the issue of climate change. One of them is the concept of feedbacks. And you gave an example of a positive feedback where a change in toward a warmer climate is self-reinforcing. And we actually have seen that going on in Greenland. A colleague of mine who works at Ohio State, Jason Box, has done some very interesting work looking at changes in the surface reflectivity of Greenland. The surface albedo is the term that we use. And what he has noticed is places, even where you don't get much melt, seem to be getting a little bit darker. And some of that, we think, is just due to, as you get even a little bit of melt, it changes the structure of the snow. And as many people know, if they've seen a fresh snowpack, it's obviously very bright and reflective. But over time, especially if you have melt, that snow becomes a little less bright and absorbs more energy. And Jason has made the point that we've seen such dramatic changes in the albedo of the surface of the Greenland ice sheet that in many places it has become self-reinforcing. In fact, he had actually predicted that we would see a year within this decade where we would see melt covering the entire Greenland ice sheet at some point. So we have that idea of feedbacks, and certainly we can think of a number of positive feedbacks in the climate system, and many of them involving ice or snow or sea ice. The other idea that you touched on was one of what we will often refer to as tipping points. So do you reach a point where you essentially can't get back to your previous climate state? And that's a little bit more difficult to address. Certainly, it's been a hotly debated point. Have we reached tipping points in terms of permafrost melt or in terms of Greenland? I think it's probably premature to say, at least in the case of Greenland, where I can speak with some authority, that we've reached a tipping point there. But certainly, we are seeing signs of the kinds of changes with these albedo changes due to additional melt that would make you wonder if we're approaching a point like that where we could not essentially recover the current mass or the mass that we've lost from Greenland.
And of course, just in terms of semantics, positive feedback doesn't convey the right message, does it?
I suppose if you're using that term, the idea is that it's moving you in the same direction rather than back. In this case, I suppose we would want to be going back. But it's the term that we commonly use. I've never quite thought about it that way. That's an interesting point.
But just though, in terms of ocean currents, does the salinity of the water, because when fresh water melts into seawater, the salinity changes, does that affect ocean currents? And we know that so much of the world's climate is based upon, you know, the great Gulf Stream and other currents.
It's certainly an active area of research. I can't say that it's an area that I can speak with a lot of authority on. But certainly we know that as you increase melt from Greenland, you are introducing fresh water into the North Atlantic. We do know that the North Atlantic is an area where you see this deep water formation or this sinking water that drives the Gulf Stream current. How much additional melt from Greenland is affecting the salinity and how that's affecting North Atlantic deep water formation, I can't really speak to that. I will say that not all of the additional freshening of water in the ocean would be due to melt from glaciers or ice caps. Simply having additional rainfall, so if you warm the climate in an area that doesn't receive as much rainfall, you receive more rainfall. That rainfall, of course, is fresh water. And that's a significant source of freshening as well.
So given that, as I mentioned, that we are unique, I think, in all of the developed countries of still having this debate about whether or not climate change is real, and the evidence appears to be mounting. Do you think, as a scientist, do you feel that we can get beyond this? And because obviously, the more we deny what is happening, the less time we have to deal with how to fix what is happening. And if, as we've discussed, you reach a tipping point because of these so-called positive feedback mechanisms, we have to basically get real here, don't we?
It's an interesting question. I think I've been paying more attention to, in the recent few years than I ever did earlier in my career, about the issue of climate communication and how as climate scientists, what our role is in the process, how do we effectively communicate information, and I think we're all working on it. Many people are more skilled at it than others. But I think there are several issues, I think, that make this discussion difficult. One of them, I think, is the conflation between the issue of atmospheric greenhouse gas changes and how that's affecting climate and the policy, potential policy implications thereof. So I think there's this conflation in people's minds that if we accept the science on this particular issue, then we are automatically following a certain course of action in terms of public policy. And I think that disconnecting those two and saying that, look, we can have a debate about public policy issues and how we deal with this situation, I think would help to advancing the conversation.
So do you think then that you need to sort of decouple the arguments over, how do you decouple the arguments over burning coal? Isn't it pretty clear what causes greenhouse gases? And one of them I mentioned earlier from the melting of the permafrost is methane. Are we having these continuous forest fires? That's putting up a lot of greenhouse gases at all. And then, of course, as you burn coal and gasoline in your cars, you also contribute to it. How can you talk about climate change and not talk about what appears to be the cause of climate change?
Well, I think we could talk about the cause of climate change. I think that there are many mechanisms by which one might act to mitigate those impacts. And this is straying away from certainly my area of expertise, but if one wants to talk about issues surrounding burning of coal, there may be more than one mechanism by which we would, you know, policy mechanism for trying to achieve that end. I do think in many people's minds, and this is just personal experience talking, interacting with public, that people do assume that you're imposing a particular policy, you know, sort of suite of policies by accepting the science. I really don't believe that's the case. But you make a completely valid point. We, you know, there are some very clear mechanisms by which we're changing atmospheric chemistry, and those are things that you know, we somehow have to find a way to address.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Thomas Mote.
Okay, thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Thomas Mote, who's a climate scientist and head of the Department of Geography at the University of Georgia. For the last 20 years, he's been using satellite imagery to study the changes in the Greenland ice sheet. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with someone who spoke yesterday with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton about ways to prevent future genocides. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Timothy Snyder, who's a professor of history at Yale. In 2010, he published Bloodlands, Europe Between Hitler and Stalin, a history of Nazi and Soviet mass killings on the lands between Berlin and Moscow. It was named a book of the year by some dozen publications and was a bestseller in four countries. Most recently, he helped Tony Judd to compose a thematic history of political ideas and intellectuals in politics, Thinking the 20th Century. Yesterday, he spoke at the Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C., along with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and other foreign policy experts about ways to avert future genocide. Welcome to Background Briefing, Timothy Snyder.
Very glad to be here.
And you brought up climate change as a possible, I guess, you know, cause of future genocides. We, of course, always had a fairly narrow definition of national security over the decades, and it would seem that since the Cold War that national threats have receded and transnational and subnational threats have taken over. But even the CIA and other intelligence agencies have been very slow in recognizing global warming as a security threat. How do we stand in that, in terms of that awareness?
Well, what I was trying to argue yesterday in D.C. is that what we know about the history of genocide, especially the causes of the Holocaust, should make us think hard about what's coming in the 21st century. We know, of course, that anti-Semitism was a central cause, that racism was a central cause. What we've been coming to understand better lately is why those ideas, which after all are very old ideas and very powerful ideas, could bring about mass killing in 1941, 1942, and not at some other time. And what we see when we take a step back and begin to look at the world the way that the Nazis saw it and the way that Hitler saw it is a kind of ecological panic. A fear that Germany would not be self-sufficient in food, a desire, crazy though it might be, to conquer enough land to become self-sufficient in food. And then here comes the anti-Semitic part, the idea that if you could only remove the Jews from Eastern Europe, then you could control the fertile soil that would make Germany into a superpower. Now, that was defeated, and it may seem like it makes no sense, but we've got no choice but to confront it seriously as an example of how ecological panic creates the space for the ideas which we understand and identify with. I worry that as we enter the 21st century, we are also entering a moment of ecological panic. What happened between the Nazis and us is that hybrids and fertilizers and irrigation and pesticides came in, created a green revolution in both the developing and the developed world, and made us forget all about food. Made us forget all about fertile soil, made us forget all about the traditional geopolitical concerns really that have dominated modern history. What global warming does, in effect, is that it undoes those green revolutions. It puts us back in a situation where we're unsure about the future of food supplies. And it also throws in a new wild card, which is water supply, which actually the CIA and American National Intelligence are beginning to pay a great deal of attention to. And many other authorities are beginning to project that global warming could lead to violent conflict. The dots I'm trying to connect is the environmental history with the history of ideas to make us see that what we've got coming isn't just about the environment, it's also about politics and, unfortunately, probably about mass murder.
Well, there's no question that Hitler's main campaign theme, if you will, in the early 30s, his appeal to the German people was Lebensraum, wasn't it? Living room, which of course reinforces what you're saying.
We don't take, you know, we hear that phrase and it sounds strange and we don't take it seriously, but it has everything to do with the Holocaust. What Hitler was calling Lebensraum, this space for the German people to live in, was already inhabited by tens of millions of other people, including the Jews. And the basic colonial idea was to destroy the Jews, the people who were putatively in charge, although of course they weren't, and to enslave the rest. As the first, you know, as a simplification, that's what the idea was. But underlying all of this ideological imperialism was this desire for territory, this desire for food, which is rooted in anxiety, not entirely an unrealistic anxiety, that Germany wasn't going to be able to feed itself now or in the future. So the concern is that as other powerful countries like China or eventually the United States look forward into the 21st century and begin to see a similar constellation, a world in which they cannot assure themselves supplies of food, ideas of that kind, I mean, that idea will never come back in the same form, but that ideas of that kind might start to seem more plausible and more normal to us. That's what I worry about.
Again, I'm speaking with Timothy Snyder. He's a professor of history at Yale University. He's the author of Bloodlands, Europe Between Hitler and Stalin, and most recently he helped Tony Judd to compose a thematic history of political ideas and intellectuals in politics, Thinking the 20th Century. Yesterday he spoke at the Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C., along with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and other foreign policy experts about ways to avert future genocide. So the current drought that we're experiencing here in the United States, and similar droughts are happening in Russia, the Ukraine, and Australia, and so it's not just the America's breadbasket that's going to have a particularly bad year, but this will be a global problem. And already, I think we're going to see, we know from the Arab Spring that much of what generated the Tunisian Revolution and the Egyptian Revolution was the price of food, was it not?
Yeah, which just goes to show how, it was also because one of the causes of the French Revolution and the Russian Revolution. So, you know, there's no need to stop there. I mean, that the relationship between material wants, especially food and water, and political change is a fundamental one. In the last 50 or 60 years, you know, basically in our lifetimes, we've gotten a free pass, and we've allowed ourselves to forget that very fundamental relationship. And that's thanks to technology, and technology, of course, is also our hope in the future. But if technology doesn't keep up to the effects of the droughts that are coming, and also just the instability that's going to come from major storms as well, then politics is likely to creep in, and that's the fundamental concern. What we need to understand is that the last half century or so is unusual in that food has been so cheap and accessible. That's historically never happened before. If we lose that, we're going to find out that all the ethical things that we prize in ourselves so highly are going to dissipate very quickly, because so much of that depends upon having a full stomach and on the prospect of indefinitely having a full stomach.
Well, we have an example of perhaps one of the most repressive and top-down controlled regimes on the planet, in North Korea, where the people have been starving on and off for decades now. So if that's a model for our future, it doesn't, in other words, the lack of food can have, in the case of the Arab Spring, arguably, it's had a beneficial effect in as much as dictators have been removed, although the fate of democracy is not entirely clear, but at least that could be seen as a more benign example. North Korea strikes me as the kind of dystopian example.
You hit on a connection that's really important. I mean, one of the ways that we are free in Western societies in the U.S. is that we're free to walk out of our doors and go buy cheap food. That's a very important freedom which we now take for granted. You know, Roosevelt called it freedom from want. We take it for granted now. We think it's just part of life. Things will always be that way. But one of the things that happens when food is scarce is that it becomes a resource which governments can monopolize. And the history of tyranny, especially in the 20th century, is full precisely of that, whether you're thinking of the millions of Soviet citizens who were starved in the early 30s or the tens of millions of Chinese citizens who were starved in the late 1950s, early 1960s. What you see is that famine always has this political side. And when it's scarce, when you don't have the ability to get it easily, then you're at risk not only of going hungry, but of becoming obedient because you need to get the food.
So in terms of the discussion yesterday at the Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C., where you spoke and so did Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton and other foreign policy experts, one from the National Intelligence Council, just give us a sense of, let's start with Hillary Clinton. What was the main theme of hers? Because I understand from statements by her husband, former President Bill Clinton, and his Vice President Al Gore, that their deepest regrets have been their inability or the failure to recognize the Rwandan genocide and deal with it. And I think what's implicit in that is that they know that with very, very minor intervention, the U.S. probably could have prevented the loss of hundreds of thousands of lives.
That's right. I mean, President Clinton has been quite forthright about that. The speech that Secretary Clinton gave yesterday represents, I think, a paradigm shift in American foreign policy. In the history of American diplomacy, genocide has always been something that we've either looked aside from, sadly, or only looked at retrospectively after it's already happened and then made up excuses for why we couldn't have done anything. Sometimes it is indeed very hard to do something, but if you don't have the lens, if you don't have the concept of genocide as being part of your foreign policy, then you don't see it when it starts to happen. And so what President Obama has done in setting up a pan-governmental board concerned with genocide prevention, and the particular policies that Secretary Clinton laid out yesterday have to do with affecting that kind of shift, where American diplomats and policymakers generally are supposed to be on the lookout for evidence of genocide and of the signs of mass killing as it begins to happen or before it happens. So that's the idea, is to give American authorities a chance to react, but also to kind of put us on our guard morally, because once you give these kinds of speeches and create these kinds of boards, you're creating the moral presumption that you are going to do something about it. Whereas, sadly, in decades in the past, the moral presumption was always that that was someone else's problem, that that went beyond sovereignty issues, and so on and so forth. So it's a pretty significant development, I would say, and I think it's going to be remembered as one of her more important speeches.
And again, I'm speaking with Timothy Snyder, professor of history at Yale University. He spoke yesterday at the National Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., along with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and other foreign policy experts about ways to avert future genocide. Now, if, as you say, the Secretary of State is cautious about raising expectations, or that would necessarily follow pronouncements about being more proactive to prevent genocide, how do you deal with the reality of Syria today? I mean, that seems to be an example of, again, the world powers sitting on the sideline, not, albeit the Russians having a very cynical role in this and the Chinese having an equally cynical role in this. Did that come up?
Oh, it certainly did. I mean, I would make a distinction here. Genocide prevention, you know, if genocide prevention happens, that means that we won't be reading about the genocide in the newspapers. That's the ironic thing. So a true policy of genocide prevention, I think, has to begin with the big issues, which for me are questions of the rule of law, questions of war prevention, and questions of the predictability of the future environment, which mainly means getting getting control over global warming. Those are the things that will actually prevent genocide. The problem there is that if you prevent a genocide, no one's ever going to get credit for it because no one's ever going to know, so to speak, that it didn't happen. Technology has probably already prevented a number of genocides, but you know, the people who invented the better fertilizers and so on aren't getting the credit for that, although in my view they probably should. By the time you get to the point of people actually killing other people or governments killing their own citizens on the ground, I wouldn't want to say it's too late. There are times that you can intervene. I would just want to emphasize that a true policy of genocide prevention would be designed to keep us from getting to that point as often as possible. Of course, we will get to that point sometimes. And when we do, what you see after President Clinton's or after Secretary Clinton's speech is a kind of presumption shift. In that speech, she did indicate that the administration was going to be stepping up contacts with the opposition in Syria, and I think they've committed themselves to something like that. But I would emphasize that it's oversimplistic to treat genocide as waiting for the bad guys to do their thing and then stepping in to stop them. That's really hard to do. Even with the best of will, that's extremely hard to do. I do think it ought to be our policy to try, but that is very hard. It's actually easier, I think, to try to prevent genocide over the long run. Unfortunately, it doesn't give you that sort of simple black and white sense of doing something good because you ride in with the cavalry. Riding in with the cavalry is actually really hard to do, unfortunately.
Well, we started out talking about Hitler, and really, Hitler made no bones about what his intentions were. He, after all, wrote about it in Mein Kampf, and clearly the world was very slow, at least the political authorities were very slow to recognize the full horror and danger of what this clique of gangsters that took over Germany were really all about. So you do have, I guess, some warning, particularly in the case of Hitler, the use of the media. And I suppose you could make an analogy with what happened in Rwanda, where the media was used to whip up a kind of genocidal frenzy. And, of course, it was a very low-tech massacre. It involved machetes. It didn't involve modern weaponry. So using that as an example, what kind of intervention? I mean, in other words, would the use of the media be a flag for early intervention?
Yes. I mean, you've now just basically restated part of Secretary Clinton's speech. That is one of the things which has changed quite a lot since the 1930s. You're quite right. In 1930s, from the publication of Mein Kampf in 1924, there were all kinds of very clear signals about the general direction of Hitler's intentions. But at that time, we did not have the language of human rights that we have now. We did not have the alertness to anti-Semitism and other forms of racism that we have now in the United States. It's very important that we understand that we were a long way from the kind of anti-racism or opposition to anti-Semitism which is prevalent now. We were unfortunately much more like Germany and other European countries in the 1930s than we would like to remember. So that's a sign of how things have changed, and really changed for the better, that we have a language of opposition to anti-Semitism, of opposition to racism, a language of human rights. And practically, as you say, we are now much more alert to the media. And one of the sadnesses of Rwanda is that we did know. We did have those signals at the time. We had them in what we like to call real time. We had them as they were coming out. And that makes our choice not to do anything all the sadder, I think, and all the more pronounced. But this was one of the things which Secretary Clinton was emphasizing, that American diplomats and others are going to be trained to follow the media, to look out for these signals, even if they're disguised as other things, even if they're disguised as stories for children, even if they're disguised as popular songs, whatever it might be, to be alert for these cues. And that's obviously smart and necessary.
Well, just in closing, Timothy Snyder, given that you spoke about global warming and the effects of it leading to the possibility of mass killings in decades to come in terms of what you described as ecological panic, how do we, in terms of being proactive, one of the problems we have in this country is that there's a substantial amount of denial about the very existence of global warming. And in many ways, I think that this binary notion in the press of fairness and balance, as Fox News calls it, where you have equal and opposite arguments, has led to the idea that climate change denial is just another opinion, in the way that creationism is another opinion vis-a-vis evolution. How are we going to get serious about it? I mean, our weathermen seem to talk about the weather in dramatic terms, but they don't ever talk about it in context. And there is a difference between weather and climate. I just have a feeling that we need a real wake-up call about what seems to be pretty obvious, that climate change is moving rapidly.
Yeah, America is really unusual. I mean, all around the world, you have a pretty much an acceptance of the scientific consensus, which is a scientific consensus. It's not a scientific controversy at all. In America, we stand out. We are unusual. We seem to think that there's a scientific controversy because we are told such, but that's simply not the case. There's no more controversy about climate change than there is about other things we think there's controversy about, like evolution or, for that matter, gravity. You know, all these things are theories, but a scientific theory is something around which there's a strong body of evidence. It's not just another opinion. And we are killing ourselves as a result of it. We are killing ourselves, we're killing the rest of the world, and we don't have that much time to get our minds around it. And one of the things I'd like to hope is that history might offer us some chance of understanding what we're capable of. If we think that the world's just going to get hotter, that we're going to lose our coastlines, and that we're going to continue to behave in reasonable democratic pluralist ways, that's absolutely crazy. There are plenty of examples of people who were just as reasonable and enlightened as we were being led towards mad behavior, crazy behavior, because of a sense of ecological threats in the future. Because the ecological threat is real, the panic is certainly going to come. And the question is whether we start amassing our efforts to in reasonable technological ways in time to head off that panic. You know, we can choose to stick our heads in the sand, and of course there's going to be more and more sand, so it's going to be easier and easier to do that. But all that will mean is that the panic will hit us harder when it comes, and we won't be ready for it. So I don't know. I mean, I can't tell you for sure that Americans are going to come round about this. The only hope I can express is that if we took the history of mass atrocity seriously, if we realize that history is something which flows forward from the past into the present, that we are not exceptions to the way that people can behave in times of stress, that we might learn something from the past that could prepare us for the future. I'm not particularly optimistic about that, but I do think it's one of the few chances that we have. In other words, I think the environmental movement and the history of atrocity are really one thing, and that all the many people of good faith who care about genocide, who care about preventing atrocity, and all the people of good faith who care about the future of the environment, the future of the planet, are slowly going to realize that their cause is a related one, and that the history of the 20th century and the future of the 21st century have much more in common, unfortunately, than we would like. There is a lesson there. I just hope it gets across in time.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Timothy Snyder.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for the questions.
Again, I've been speaking with Timothy Snyder, who's professor of history at Yale. In 2010, he published Bloodlands, Europe Between Hitler and Stalin, a history of Nazi and Soviet mass killings in the lands between Berlin and Moscow. And most recently, he helped Tony Judd to compose a thematic history of political ideas and intellectuals in politics, Thinking the 20th Century. Yesterday, he spoke at the Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C., along with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and other foreign policy experts about ways to avert future genocide. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.